Welcome.
Benvenuti.
Ehlen wa sahlen.
Willkommen.
Ekabo.
Kushan dadit.
Atopei norunia. Here on earth.
Here on earth.
Here on earth. Kalos orisete sto here on earth.
Welcome to Here on Earth.
I was covering a small protest of mothers looking for information on their sons and their husbands, and at that point I was picked up by police. So I had at the time about 30 friends following my Twitter. I sent that message to the Twitter site and it reposted to all my friends. They were then able to call my embassy, call my school, and get things in motion to help me. I got replies within seconds.
James Buck is a lucky guy, an American college student who got himself arrested in Egypt for snapping some photos in the wrong place at the wrong time, used Twitter to send the single word arrested on his cell phone. 24 hours later, he was free, escorted from jail by the American consul, thanks to the intercession of his social network. James Bush's interpreter was not so lucky. He's still languishing in jail. Welcome to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. I'm Jean Faraca. This hour, the promises and perils of social networking. Do you use it? What's the downside, do you think? Will real friends be replaced by virtual ones? Is your virtual life eclipsing your real life? Can you even tell the difference anymore? We're at 1-800-642-1234. Again, that's 1-800-642-1234. You can also send an email to hereonearth@wpr.org. Mark Pesce is one of the early pioneers in virtual reality, a writer, researcher, and teacher on the future of technology. He's published 5 books on technology and is working on a 6th that's entitled The Human Network, Sharing Knowledge and Power in the 21st Century. He joins us from Australia, where it's only 6 a.m. Mark Pesce, thanks so much for getting up so early for us.
Good day.
How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Watching the sunrise.
Have you gotten any text messages yet today?
No, actually, I haven't. Most of my own communication streams, although some of them do come in via text messaging, most of them will come in via email or through the Twitter service.
And I wonder if you just heard that newscast that the first people who will know who Barack Obama's choice of VP is will be his friends. I mean, his social networking friends. A message went out just yesterday, I think, asking people on his social network if they want to be the first to know. Can you comment on that?
Yes, I actually got the same message myself. I thought that was actually it's a brilliant stroke because it's a way to give people a sense of real involvement, you know, that they won't be able to just hear it by tuning into the news or tuning into the, something, some other source, or going to the web, but they'll actually get that connection on their mobile phone. And so if you want something that's going to really make people feel very loyal with respect to the candidate, I think that's going to do it.
So it's that connection. Tell us more about what you mean by that and why you emphasize that word. Does it make people feel special to be text messaged by Barack Obama?
I mean, I think at one level it absolutely does, even though everyone is absolutely sure that this is not Barack tapping at a message on his BlackBerry or whatever to send along. I think everyone is also clear that it implies that there is a relationship there. We, in all of the rest of our lives, build our relationships around these moments of communication, and we've been doing this for at least 11 million years, since long before we were human. We were a very sort of social animal, and so the more that you reinforce those moments of connection and communication along the social lines, those moments become the actual sort of substructure. They become the scaffolding of all of our culture and all of our human relationships. And so all Barack is doing is simply taking that and bringing that into the very modern sort of 2008 twist, the 2008 accent for a very, very old language.
Can you comment on the way social networking tools are actually changing the way we do politics, especially with regard to Barack Obama's campaign?
Well, the interesting thing about Obama's campaign is that it's very much sort of a blend of old-fashioned techniques and new-fashioned techniques. At one level, and this probably comes from his own work as a community organizer, he has a lot of people and a lot of boots on the ground everywhere that they're campaigning. And they actually use the original human network, which is just going door-to-door and face-to-face and getting people excited and getting people involved. But in parallel to that, you also then have the entire campaign going on Facebook and the other social networking sites. But Facebook was, I think, the particular focus of their campaign, where people could become a friend of Barack Obama. That could then be used to help generate leads for, say, email or for getting people to get out to vote events or getting people to come in and actually donate money to the campaign. And we know that the campaign has been extraordinarily successful in terms of the number of low-level donations that have been coming in, presumably through these connections that have been established, not just face-to-face, but through the social media that have been used over the course of the campaign. Now, when you sign up and become a part of the Barack Obama campaign, you can then sign up to a social network that's internal to the site, mybarackobama.com. And then inside that site, you can then find out people who are near you or people who are affiliated with you or people who have interests similar to you. And so you basically form your own social network inside the wider circle of the campaign. And so you can actually go out and work for the candidate, or you can go pool your interests with other people who are involved in the campaign.
Mm. Of course, we have other examples of social networking tools used to actually kill a campaign. For example, here's an excerpt from a now-famous 2006 YouTube video featuring George Allen, the Republican candidate for Senate in Virginia.
It's important that we motivate and inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere. And it's just great. We're going to places all over Virginia. And he's having it on film, and it's great to have you here. And you show it to your opponent because he's never been there and probably will never come. So it's good for you.
An Indian American supporter of his Democratic opponent, Jim Webb, caught Allen using that racial slur, Makaka, and Webb wound up winning that election.
Yeah, poor George Allen.
Well,
it's really interesting because he was, I don't know if he was quite the first, but he was certainly within the very couple first politicians who are now living in this intense age. You could almost call it an age of panopticon, where absolutely everything is absolutely recorded and transmitted and exposed and analyzed if you are a public person. And so George Allen could not watch his language and his persona every single moment of every single day. And of course, this phenomenon began with, in some sense, the politicians, that they were the first ones placed under this microscope. And now we're seeing how it's spreading to the rest of the culture. And one of the things that we're learning is that none of us is prepared to hold up to the standards of decency and morality and public taste that we would actually be holding our own politicians to.
Yeah, it really is blurring the distinction between public and private. There are no private moments that really escape the scrutiny of the possible video camera or the we just never know when we're on mic, somebody's mic.
Yeah, no, this is absolutely true, and I mean I think that one of the things we'll start seeing in the 21st century are the no camera zones, the non-recording zones being particularly treasured as a place where people will go to truly be themselves. At the same time, you know, we now see kids with their Facebook pages or their MySpace pages, and they're sitting there with a beer bong and some nasty slogan on a T-shirt, and this is up for the entire world to see, and their parents are like, what happens if you want to go into politics in 20 years? And of course, the answer to that is going to be that if you actually are running for politics in 20 years and people can't dig up this kind of information on you, they're going to be extremely suspicious. Because we're all going to have that, because in some sense, all of the dirty laundry is being aired. And for most people, vast majority, 99.44% of all people, the worst of your dirty laundry is really just not going to be all that exciting.
That's a funny way of putting it. But you've said that what this constitutes, in a way, is another form of mob rule.
I mean, this is, we need to be very careful around that term, but I think that term is very potent, because we now have the capability, and not just the capability, but the actuality for groups of people to do something, to find each other wherever they are over the planet and take themselves and focus their efforts around a particular point, whether it's a political campaign or whether it's something that they want to actually buy or something that they want to make, or Wikipedia, which is now a collection of human knowledge, and Wikipedia is driven at its essence by 2,000 incredibly dedicated individuals, some of whom are working against the wishes of their local governments. And it's those 2,000 people tooling away every single day because it's a labor of love to them, are now creating this encyclopedia that absolutely everyone else has access to. So when you have elements like that in play, yeah, you can talk about that as almost a type of mob rule, because it's not predictable. It's being driven in some sense by passion, by what's getting people excited, but it's being supported by this new way to be able to draw people together almost instantaneously and allow them to then share the work, or crowdsource is the word that's used, share the work involved in a major task.
We just got an instant message from Rex, who says, I'm 20 years old. I check Facebook 10 times and send 50 text messages a day. I'm a camp counselor, or where electronics are forbidden. At first, it felt like I was going to die. Now I got used to it. Today's youth have an e-addiction. My question is, if it's this bad already, what does the future hold?
That's a really good question. See, it's interesting to note, I want to make a point here. 400 years ago, the leading minds of the day were screaming about the addiction to the novel. And, you know, the young ladies were being absorbed by these very, very sort of nasty and provocative stories that they were reading. And so we have this real sort of, I think, desire to over-characterize any transition in cultural norms as a form of addiction. It is an addiction if it keeps you from doing the other things that you love or I think are important. But I think what we're doing through Facebook and SMSing is we're spending these times connecting to other people. That's one of the most important things we will do. As long as that doesn't stand in the way of the real face-to-face connection, and in general, people on Facebook aren't sitting at home in the dark. People using SMS aren't sitting at home in the dark. They're actually using these to reach out and connect to other people so they can improve the overall quality of their social lives. And I think that what the future holds is that we will see better tools for being able to do that, because the tools we have now are in some sense very primitive, and they're going to evolve around our desire to stay connected.
We're talking this hour about the promise and the perils of social networking. Mark Pesce is one of the early pioneers in virtual reality. He's a writer, researcher, and teacher on the future of technology. He's very big on social networking. He calls it human networking. I'm Jean Ferraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. We're at 1-800-642-1234. You can send an email to hereonearth@wpr.org, or IM us. The screen name is Here on Earth Radio. You can use AOL or MSN Instant Messenger. I'm Jean Faraca. HereOnEarth.org is the perfect companion to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. Learn more about our guests, topics, and the music we feature. You can subscribe to our podcast, post a message, and interact with other listeners. Log on to HereOnEarth.org and join us live Monday through Friday at 3 on Wisconsin Public Radio.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Qualline Fence in Wanakee, a family-owned company serving residential and commercial customers in southern Wisconsin. Information at quallinefence.com. Qualline Fence, proud to sponsor Wisconsin Public Radio for over 20 years.
Wisconsin Public Radio is a sponsor of the Music and Media Conference, connecting media producers including music, film, radio, print, and TV. Open to the public September 10th at the UW Oshkosh campus. Information at wpr.org/mmc.
That's a cell phone video posted to YouTube of the 2005 anti-Lebanese race riots in Sydney, Australia. Some officials blamed text messages for inciting the violence. Also interesting is this YouTube video. People monitored the event on their cell phones and immediately posted it online for discussion afterwards. I'm Jean Faraca. You're listening to Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders. This hour, Mark Pesce is with us. He has studied the power of the new social networking tools in great depth and is really the philosopher of social networking. I think that's a good way to put it. Mark, obviously, we've given examples so far this hour of the Twitter being used to save a life in the case of that American college student who was arrested in Egypt. And here we have people's lives imperiled by social networking. There are other examples, too. You've written about the suicide pacts that have evolved through Facebook and so forth. And obviously, we've read about cyberspace bullying, which has resulted in some very serious problems.
Yeah, I mean, the thing that we need to be completely clear on is that, I mean, technologies in general are amplifiers. They amplify some native human capability. So a steam engine amplifies our muscles. A television amplifies our ability to see over distances. While social networks amplify our abilities to either bring people into groups or cast people out of groups. And this is the thing. So you can actually have now, as you had with the mob in Cronulla in December 2005, you have basically Anglo-Celtic white supremacists who shared a text message among themselves by taking the text messages and forwarding it and forwarding and forwarding it among their mates over a week's time, so that by the time Sunday, the day of the riots, rolled around, you had several thousand people down there who were all of like mind. Because what happened is the message would come into someone's mobile phone, and immediately that person would know who they'd want to share that message with in their own human network in order to be able to get that message out. So they would forward it along, and it would end up in someone else's phone, and they'd look at it and say, oh, I know who this has to go to. So you got like-minded people. So social networks have this intense capability to be able to amplify groups of like-minded people, and that has a positive aspect and it has a negative aspect, and we aren't going to be able to run away from either of those.
You know, when you think about it, we don't have to get so fancy about these new tools to consider how that worked in Rwanda, when it was radio, as a matter of fact, who helped incite the genocide there. Hate radio.
Yeah, I mean, it's really the technology in itself is less important than the social network. Now, the thing about radio, though, is that it's intrinsically a one-way medium. And so there isn't this chance, I guess, to get the back channel in to be able to connect, to close the loop, so that people can think that they're sort of hearing what's going on, but to be able to feel like they're being swept up in or involved in what's going on actually does require completing the connection. So it's not just what you're hearing, but it's what you're being able to respond to.
Oh, you know, as someone who's been a talk show host in public radio for something like 20 years now, I have to say that radio is interactive. And as a matter of fact, to prove it, we have Janice joining us right now from Madison. Hi, Janice.
Hi, this is actually Janet.
Oh, Janet, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Thank you. I love the show. I just wanted to comment on how I've had a friend that I've known since I was 15 years, and we met on a six-week camping trip. And now that we're, you know, in our early to mid-30s, I've reconnected back in old town. And when I visit him, he's so engrossed with what he's been working on in the computer, not gaming or anything, but, you know, it's a whole other topic, but engrossed with what he's hoping to, you know, turn into some sort of business on the computer, that when I go to visit for, say, maybe 2 hours or so, I'd lucky if I get like a 15-minute long non-interrupted conversation. Mostly it's focused on, you know, the computer. I had to practically beg him to walk around the block the other day.
You know, I really sympathize, Janet, and I'm so glad you brought that up. Yes, the messages are flying back and forth. The phones are ringing. The ringtones are driving us mad. And what about, you know, actually an 18-year-old told me the other day that she didn't really think that she could sit down across a dinner table with a friend for a whole hour and have a conversation. She much preferred the interrupted kind. Now, what does that say about the quality of our connectivity?
Yeah. I mean, it definitely says that we're undergoing a change right now. When you're talking about someone who is so, colonized by the other things that he's doing in life that he can't spend quality time with a friend who's coming to visit, that's obviously someone who's going to sort of take a step back and be able to prioritize. Because what they've done is they've reprioritized their life around other influences other than the immediacy, the immediate presence of people. With respect to the kids around the dinner table, it's already known that the kind of casualness that you get and the kind of consistency that you get from, say, a long-term SMS conversation versus sort of very intense and very face-to-face human embodied conversation, it's going to be different, and people are in general going to be sort of more comfortable with that. I mean, I'll tell you a little story. I came to America a few weeks ago to speak at a conference, and I traveled 10 time zones and landed to visit a friend in Massachusetts, and I got to his house, he fed me dinner, and then we sat down, and we kind of laughed because we had nothing to say to each other because we managed to talk via email and instant messaging basically every day. So we were caught up on each other's lives. And so when we were actually in physical presence with one another, there was just like, oh, good to see you.
Oh, my goodness. But, I mean, here's what I don't understand. I mean, just look at the words that have come out of this. Flickr, Twitter, Facebook, MySpace. To me, it all sounds like teenager jargon. And it has that kind of narcissism that you associate with 15-year-olds. I mean, is that the model that with the rest of us are expected to follow? And I mean, I remember coming home from school and picking up the phone and calling my friend whom I just said goodbye to. But I wouldn't go back to listen to that conversation.
Yeah, I mean, all of this is still quite new, so we don't quite understand whether these are simply tools that amplify narcissism. They can clearly be used to amplify your love of yourself, but the other thing that they can do is they can present a very specific view of yourself as you would like to be seen by other people, which is not the same thing as narcissism. The people can actually sort of use it to rehearse things that they're trying to find inside of themselves. And we know that students in classrooms, if they're given the opportunity to interact verbally or they're given the opportunity to interact through electronic means by sending email or a chat window to the instructor, that there are certain students who will do very well verbally, but there are other students, again, just as bright, people will do much better electronically, that this form of mediation actually works better for the way they work. And so it's not an either or here. It's actually having sort of the multiplicity of possibilities for any particular person to feel comfortable in any particular situation.
We're at 1-800-642-1234. We have open lines for anyone who'd like to join in. Even if you don't know what Twitter is, this is the opportunity for you to ask. It's all coming so fast and furious, and it is changing so much, whether we like it or not, it seems to me. And I've heard this argument that it's either or, and maybe it is, but it does seem to me that it's becoming more and more dominant. It's very, very difficult to escape from the use of email and cell phones. People don't have regular telephones anymore. They have cell phones. And, I mean, tell us about the phone you're talking to us on, Mark.
Well, yeah, no, this is, I only have a cell phone. When I moved to Australia, I made a conscious decision that I wasn't going to have a landline anymore. So I only have a mobile phone. And it's interesting because mobile phones were adopted fairly rapidly in Australia. And it was, I think, during my first trip to Australia, which was in 1997, I actually got to see what happened to a culture once you got past the sort of halfway point. Because the Australians got there about 4 or 5 years before the Americans did in that respect. And the thing that you learned was that the mobile phone became what I call the social hormone, in that it basically accelerated and smoothed out social situations. We don't think about how profound. We think about, you know, there's ringtones and everyone's on their mobile talking in public when they shouldn't be. What we don't think about is that no one is actually late anymore, that when you arrive late somewhere without having sent a text or a call, you are immediately presumed that you've been rude or that you were trapped in the bowels of the earth. And that this is a fairly radical change in behavior, but we're so well connected now, this phenomenon of being hyper-connected, that there's an expectation now that all of these human interactions are going to be naturally lubricated by this connectivity.
Your phone, it's an iPhone, it's a web browser, you can get email on it, you can send text messages and receive them, you can surf the web. You once surfed the entire web, I bet you couldn't do that anymore. But you know what? A listener just called in to complain about the quality of your iPhone, the sound.
Right. Steve, I'm definitely, I'm using an iPhone. It's brand new here. We've been waiting for it to come out. And it's because, you know, what it does is it collapses all of those different kinds of connectivity into a single device that's being carried with me everywhere. And I'm a very keen observer of how people use their phones. That's part of my research work. And you do see some people, particularly in the United States, think of the phone as a voice-only device, and they tend to just use it for really, really good voice conversation. And in the rest of the world, that behavior is almost completely different, where people will actually use it for text messaging first, then they'll think of using it for voice conversation, except, of course, where business is involved or where a relationship is involved. But quite often, the bulk of your communication is actually going to be text messaging. It's not going to be voice communication, and that's sort of made, it's transformed what the phone is. It's transformed how we look at the phone, where it's not just this line to another party, but it's this ability to send some text from one place to another. And when you add that to a system like Twitter, which allows me to send the text message to Twitter and then have it shared with as many people who care to follow what I have to say on Twitter, it becomes very profound.
We have Joe joining us from Wausau next, and open lines for anyone else. We're at 1-800-642-1234. We're talking about social networking tools and the way they are changing our social lives. Joe, thank you for your call. Go ahead.
Hi. When I was in high school, not too long ago, about 5 years ago, I was practically married to my cell phone. I text messaged constantly. And it really helped me stay connected socially. But once I got out of high school and I entered the professional world, my cell phone became more and more of a nuisance, and I ended up hating it. I can't stand the ability of anybody I know being able to get a hold of me at any time they want. and if I don't answer my phone, I'm suddenly ignoring them. So about a year and a half ago, I decided to give up my cell phone and take out a landline again so that people can't get a hold of me at all times, and if I want my space, I can let it go to voicemail, and I might not be home for all they know. Unfortunately, I had to get a cell phone again for my job, but I got a prepaid phone that nobody knows the number to, and I like to keep it that way. I just like to make the comment that although I love social networking, I have a MySpace page, I think we need to also respect other people's ability to be by themselves and not be contacted. And, yeah, I guess that's it.
So from that was a short-lived marriage, and now, obviously, you're moving towards monasticism.
That's right.
I really enjoy your comment, Joe. Thank you so much. How would you respond, Mark?
Oh, I mean, I think that sums it up beautifully. The power of hyperconnectivity is so intense that we don't normally even think in terms of being able to drop out, to become a monk, as you put it really so well. And we need to preserve that. We need to preserve that whether you're going to do it long term, as Joe has done, or if you need to do it for an hour or for a day or for a week or for a month. And we haven't learned how to carve out those spaces. One of the reasons that I talk a lot to educators is because we see the kids who are being very, very adept in using all this technology and all this hyperconnection, but they haven't really learned, because no one's taught it to them, and it's not a skill that they were born with, they haven't really learned how to carve out the time that they need when they need to think through something, and that thinking through is a solid process without any interruptions. And so we're going to all have to learn, when we have all these phones ringing and all these emails coming in and all these text messages flowing through and around us, we're all going to have to learn how to carve out a space for quiet and contemplation there.
You know, following along the monasticism metaphor, it strikes me as rather ironic that so many of us are taking up meditation, and at the same time, we've increased the mind chatter through these social networking tools.
I think that's part and parcel. I think that's exactly it. We need the meditation because we have increased the mind chatter, because we need to, in a sense, the meditation space is the space where we can't be reached. Yeah. I mean, so I think that's probably not a bad thing, and it may in fact be a foundation for being able to create that space in ourselves. But I think families also need to be able to say, okay, this is dinner hour. I mean, I called some friends of mine about 500 k's north of here a couple of months ago, and their son, their 16-year-old son, answered the phone. And he said, "Hi, Mark, I'm sorry, we're eating dinner now. Call back in an hour." Mm-hmm. And you forget about this. You forget about the fact that families used to have dinner hours, and the television wasn't on and nothing else was on. The family was just sitting and talking to one another, because we don't practice that anymore. But we actually need to get back to retrieving those spaces of non-connectivity, because it's not that we're sitting alone. It's that we're connecting immediately with the people who are immediately around us. We need to be able to put that back into its proper place as a valued human event, just as we have all of the other stuff.
Now, wait a minute. Did I just hear you say that the family meal is a form of non-connectivity?
No. It's a form of connectivity that's not electronic. I did not say that it was non-connectivity. It is a form of connectivity, but it's a form of embodied connectivity. It's not electronic. It's not flowing through a medium.
Thank God. not yet, anyway. We're talking. I promise you, Mark, I'm going to give you a chance to prove to us that this stuff is really worthwhile right after this break. I'm Jean Faraca. We're talking this hour with Mark Pesce in Australia. He is an expert on social networking, and we are talking about the promises and perils of the new technologies this hour. We're at 1-800-642-1234. Our email address, hereonearth@wpr.org. Plenty of open lines right now, and room for you in this conversation. Here on Earth, Radio Without Borders is the interactive radio show that features voices from all over the world. How about yours? The program airs live weekday afternoons at 3 Central Time, and podcast listeners can stream the show at our website, hereonearth.org. To join the conversation, call toll-free in the United States and Canada, 1-800-642-1234. Elsewhere, drop us an email, hereonearth@wpr.org. Leave your phone number and we'll call you back. You can also post your thoughts at our web forum or leave a message at my blog. We're Radio Without Borders, here on Earth, from Wisconsin Public Radio.
信息一直断断续续的, 就是说如果要通话的话,
because it was very difficult to get the call through, and the signals were very bad. So I started to think maybe I should try text message. Then I tried to text message my father.
That's Vina Mu Ni, a Chinese girl who used text messaging to check on her family after this year's earthquake. Texting is extremely popular in China as it's quick, inexpensive, and saves battery power compared to using a regular phone. And Mark, tell us about the way the news of the earthquake was disseminated as a really classic example, if we can call it that, of the way social networking tools are superseding even things like the Associated Press.
Yeah, it was really true. Because the earthquake was widespread over a fairly large portion of China, what had happened was that, I could see this happening from Sydney as it happened. It was about 5:30 p.m. in Sydney, 2:30 p.m. in China. And what you saw through Twitter, so all these people sort of sharing messages with one another, or all these people going, wait, what's going on? The building is shaking. And these are people who were in Shanghai or in Beijing or in Hong Kong because the earthquake was felt over a fairly wide area. And it, depending on how long it was afterward, they would pick themselves up and go, gee, what was that? And it was almost as if they did a shout-out to one another, hey, can I talk to you? Can I talk to you? Can I talk to you? And fairly quickly, this is within a few minutes' time, it was clear that there was parts of China that were simply not visible, that people simply were not responding. That became the entire province where the earthquake had happened. And so this all of this had come out, say, 30 minutes before the AP News broke that there was an earthquake in China. And so I actually wandered off to an event that evening and asked my friends if they'd heard about the earthquake in China. Of course, they hadn't yet because it hadn't actually broken on the news.
Mm-hmm.
And then for the next, say, 36 hours, as people were trying to get reporters, the BBC and the New York Times and so forth were trying to get reporters into the earthquake zone, but couldn't because the bridges had literally fallen down, what you actually saw was a steady stream of news coming out through Twitter, because the places that did have connectivity would actually act as sort of little beacons for messages to come in and out through Twitter.
Mm.
And so I was actually more able to follow the story from my living room in Sydney than most people were on the front pages of the New York Times.
Tell us what you mean by hyper-connectivity.
Well, we've always had a certain level of connectivity in culture. We've had embodied connectivity, so I get together with you in face-to-face. We have extended that to some degree with electronic connectivity, and most electronic connectivity has been one way, so it's a television broadcast or a radio broadcast, or a phone call. Now what we're getting is we're getting connected from so many different points, and not just from so many different points, but to so many different points, that we've actually sort of taken that out of any sort of what we would consider normal connectivity, anything that we've grown up with, anything that we've evolved into over several hundred thousand years of human evolution, into this, in a sense, it's an entirely new realm, and that's why I'm calling it hyperconnectivity, because if I can go out and send a message instantaneously to 1,500 other people, or if I can hear from 1,000 other people at the drop of a hat when I'm asking about something, if I can say, hey, who's interested in this, and then get 400 people who might be interested to work with me on this, and so on and so forth, and I can just do these things as a matter of course without really thinking about it, without really working hard to make this happen, then I've got this entirely new form of connectivity. So that's hyperconnectivity.
You say we each possess a nuclear option, the capability to go wide instantaneously, bringing the hyperconnected attention of the human network to a single point. Explain. Mm.
So James Buck, whom you opened this broadcast with, the fellow who was in Egypt, James had 30 people or so that were listening to his Twitter account, so he sends the word arrested to them. And then the wheels start to grind, and so really what happens is the Egyptian government becomes painfully aware that although this is just a college student who was taking photographs where he shouldn't have been taking photographs, in fact, what's behind him is a whole apparatus of people who are watching and recording and sharing the information about James Buck as it's happening. And so what we have now is if the moment is important enough to catch the eye of the people who might be watching, and of course that varies, it could be trivial, it could be very, very important, but if you can catch that eye, and now all of us have that capability to catch the eye, then you can actually get that eye to turn into a very piercing gaze. And that gaze can basically knock down prison walls. That's what we're starting to learn. It can expose the lies. That's also what we're starting to learn. It can ruin careers. That's also what we're starting to learn. It's a very, very potent force, and it's only just been unleashed.
We have Allie joining us from La Crosse next. Hi, Allie.
Hi. I started my internet social connections through a blog, and through my blog, I ended up meeting and interacting with people from across the world. Kind of transferred it out of my blog because I just didn't have the time to write and comment and the things that a blog just necessarily needs to Facebook. And on Facebook, I have, you know, my friends from the blog world that, you know, we're able to connect quickly. But then I've also been able to meet people from around the world that I now consider friends that I've never actually met face-to-face, but via Facebook or via, you know, whatever other way we connect, you know, it's broadened definitely how many people I connect with and the range of people. And so I think that it's not just, you know, people sitting behind a computer, but it's just this, the mere fact that here in Wisconsin, I'm sitting in, you know, La Crosse, Wisconsin, and I'm having a conversation with my friend in India or my friend in Australia and, you know, able to make those connections that we wouldn't have been able to make.
Allie, do you think that it's changed your definition or your understanding of the word friend?
I think it has, but I also think that it's in some ways deepened it, because sometimes the connections that you make, it seems to people who maybe don't use those different devices to connect with people, it seems on a very base level to be very shallow. But I think sometimes it's deeper than the connections that we make with people face-to-face, because those connections, you don't necessarily have to have a conversation. You don't actually have to have a topic. You know, you're sharing that moment. But when you're connecting with somebody and all you're connecting is maybe via words or something, you know, a topic of some nature, you can actually connect on a deeper level than sometimes what I do with my friends when, you know, I'm sitting across the table from them.
Mm, interesting. Mark Pesce, how would you respond?
This is a very interesting sort of transition that we're seeing. The online friendships that we have aren't qualitatively different. They're being expressed through a qualitatively different medium where it's not just going and hanging out with your friends, which is that's the behavior that we, I think, historically, because we've grown up with it, that's what we think of, oh, that's what our friends are. It's someone you go and hang out with. It's not someone that you engage through some sort of really mediated connection. So whether email or Facebook is that connection, we don't think of it in those terms. And we still haven't really started to learn how to put that to the test, that, you know, your friends are there with you through thick and thin. Well, what does that mean when you're online? Is that like James Buck crying out that he's been arrested and having his friends jump in and help him out? Is that what friendship, is that how you demonstrate friendship in this highly mediated universe that we're moving into? Because that's the real test here. It's because we have this capability to have these many, many more relationships than we had before. I don't think that we got the capability to have many more intense relationships. There's this thing called Dunbar's number, which basically sets the size of the number of close relationships that we can have. And for a human being, it seems to be it's around 150. And we can't get any bigger than that because it seems to be related to how big our brains are. And so no matter what, even if we manage to have, say, 1,000 friends on Facebook or 5,000 friends on MySpace or whatever it might be, in our heads, there's still only going to be about 150 people that we're actually thinking we can really count on in an emergency. Now, we may have come to know some of those people through Facebook, or we may have come to know some of those people because we grew up with them. I think it's going to be less important then. But what's going to be important is going to be, will they come when I need them?
Yeah, that is the test, isn't it? Curtis joins us from Madison next. Hi, Curtis.
Hello. Mark, you've got some great insights. So I wanted to know if you were aware of a phenomenon in China that I was made aware of by a roommate of mine this summer, who is a Chinese citizen. He's getting his PhD here in the U.S. I saw him on Chinese message boards almost every night, and I asked him what they were saying, what they were talking about. He described really a national conversation of everyone, or nearly everyone, connected in China to the internet that he gets his news from, because he knows that the news agencies in China rarely tell the whole story. But he says that within an hour or two of a major event, not as major as the earthquake even, but even a minor event that infringed on someone's rights, the entire country can know within a matter of hours. I wonder if you're aware of this.
Yeah. The answer is absolutely. This is one of the things that I study. One of the things that we've started to understand is a phenomenon that we would call Gilmore's Law. And Gilmore's Law is that the net finds a way around censorship. That's Gilmore's Law in a nutshell. And so what's happening, and the net isn't the wiring, then it is the people who are connected together. And what's happening is that the Chinese are building their own network. They're building a human network where information is being passed hand to hand to make up for the fact that the news media is being censored by the central government. The same thing happens here, where you have, you know, different kinds of communities talking about issues that are important to them and sharing the things that they know or believe here as well. It's just that in China, because the censorship is more visible, the reaction to it is also more visible. But yes, absolutely, and it's a beautiful example. Thank you for that.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you very much, Curtis. This speaks, I think, directly to your idea, Mark, that this new way of communicating is really very transparent.
It can be very transparent. Because there's such because we don't necessarily have a central point that we're getting the truth from anymore, it can be transparent in the sense that there are a lot of people who are coming to consensus around it and who will argue it out. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's true. That's the thing. You can have something that's transparent and it's transparently wrong. But because you've managed to gather a whole bunch of like-minded people who are going to confirm themselves in their opinions, you're going to be able to get something that's hilariously wrong while at the same time being hilariously transparent.
Also, it's the place that you can hide out and make an altogether alternative identity.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, you can have an alternative belief system and be not be confronted by people who are going to challenge that alternative belief system. So in that, it will be transparent. But at the same time, you can have the confluence of transparency and truth. And that's then when it's like a knife that's cutting through all sorts of institutions, because whether it's a political institution or a commercial institution or a social institution, they can't actually stand up against a group of people who are hyper-connected and are in possession of the truth and have a point that they want to make.
We have an instant message from Rex, who says, I don't tell my friends I listen to NPR or they would make fun of me. I don't even tell them that I listen to the radio. In this day and age, anything less than an iPod is unacceptable by popular standards. This is what I meant by the dominant mode. I listen in secret and have just as much fun. That's funny. Tom joins us from West Bend. We've talked about how social networking can save lives. Tom says that its slaves' lives. Tom?
Yeah, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to give a little anecdote about being connected all the time to everybody, whether it's internet, cell phone, or any other kind of medium. One of the experiences I had in my life is when I was very young, I was with my dad someplace in a place where there were long lines of people. I don't remember where it was. And I remember seeing a ring of keys on this fellow's belt loop that was standing near us. And I said to my dad, I said, you know, look at how important that guy is, that he has access to all those locks. And he looked down at me and he said, well, he said, think about it this way. He says, look at how many locks that man belongs to. And there was a fellow that was talking a few minutes ago about his cell phone, how he gave it up for a while and so on. And that struck me as being kind of that same philosophy where he looked and he said, I don't want to belong to all those people. Mm-hmm. So this is a fascinating program. I've been listening to it since it started. And secretly,
would you tell your friends?
Well, maybe I don't want to belong to their lock. But anyway, Mark, my hat's off to you. That's a great study, and I agree with you on many of the points, specifically the one that we really haven't, as a people on this planet, we really haven't figured out what the pitfalls and what the advantages are to this mass communication we have, because it's passed from one to the other by people we don't even know sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Tom. Go ahead.
And I think that we're going to find this is going to be one of the points of tension through at least the next, say, decade, but probably through most of the 21st century, is this drive to be connected and this desire to actually draw and establish some sense of personhood. We're going to see this. I think it's going to get reflected in art. It's going to get reflected in teaching. It's going to get reflected in parenting throughout the 21st century. How do we establish those boundaries? Because those boundaries are, there's no question that those boundaries are going to be different for, say, a child is being born right now than they were for me being born 45 years ago. Mm. And we're going to actually move from there into some new definition of what it means to be a human being in the context of a culture.
And I love the way you quote Margaret Mead. I happen to have this quote on my bulletin board. Never underestimate the ability of a small group of committed individuals to change the world. Your point, Mark, is that now we have the tools to do so. I want to thank you so much for being with us this hour. Mark Pesce.
Thank you.
You can find links to Mark and his blog, The Human Network, when you log on to Here on Earth. org, where you'll also find free MP3s of our show. If you'd like to purchase a CD of today's program, call the radio store 1-800-747-7444. This is program number 811K. Joe Hartke is our technical director. Lisa Boo is our webmaster. Maria Putzer took your phone calls. Social Networking, The Human Network, was produced by Lisa Boo with the cooperation of the Division of International Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Online at international.wisc.edu. I'm Jean Faraca. Thanks for listening.